In re application of the United States of America for historical cell site data. Mr. Judish.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Nathan Judish on behalf of the United States. In this appeal, the United States is seeking a limited set of information, a phone company's historical records of the location of its cell towers and the associated face of those cell towers used to send or receive a phone call or a text message on behalf of a customer. The government is not seeking information concerning the phone's location when the phone is idle, and it is only seeking the single tower used to transmit the call or text message at the beginning and the end of the call. So it's not seeking any kind of triangulation information, and it's not seeking any kind of GPS information. These are business records made by the That's correct, Your Honor. So if someone is driving, that's correct. It is the single tower at the beginning of the call and the single tower at the end of the call. Those are, if you're traveling along the interstate, it's likely those would be different towers.
Now, this is stored information that the U.S. attorney goes to the supplier, the cell phone company. To whom does the magistrate order?
When we obtain a 2703D order, it's addressed to the cell phone company. So here we're seeking orders to Metro PCS, a cell provider, and to T-Mobile, a cell provider. And we're asking them to disclose their historical business records that they've chosen of their own discretion to keep.
And this is something that a magistrate decides on a showing of continuing criminal investigation.
That's right, Your Honor. The Stored Communications Act, 18 U.S.C. Section 2703D.
I understand.
Yes. So if we present specific and articulable facts, the records we are seeking are relevant and material to an ongoing criminal investigation, then the magistrate judge, or it can be a district court, issues a 2703D order, which we then present to the phone company, and the phone company then delivers to us whatever records it has which are relevant to the 2703D order.
So what exactly, under 2703, what exactly in these cases has the United States told the magistrate or sought from the magistrate as a basis for the order? Is it an application for the messages sent from the initiating cell phone to a locality which may be at a different tower, but you don't know in the application? What is the nature of the application?
Well, the application does a couple of things. I mean, the application includes a section setting forth the facts of the investigation, which are sufficient to establish that the records sought are relevant material to an ongoing criminal investigation. And the application also describes the records that the government is seeking. I will note in this case that the application initially included broader language requesting more information.
Now,
from
you said the record the government is seeking. What do you mean by that?
The records the government is seeking. By that I mean the business records stored by the phone company, which will be a list.
What business records does the government know about?
Well, we know the categories of information that the providers store when a call is made, and so I could direct you to A79, I believe. Yes, A79 is a redacted set of records of the kind produced by T-Mobile, and it shows the kind of records they include for each telephone call. It'll include things like the date and time of the call, the duration of the call, a code which specifies which of its cell towers was used to process the call, the beginning and end of the call, and dialed number information and dialing number information and things like that. And so when we obtain one of these 2703D orders, the phone company responds by sending us the set of the information it's saved for the calls along the lines of what you see in that T-Mobile record.
Are you seeking also records on the registration of the phones when it's in a passive state, when it gets near one of these towers?
No, Your Honor. At this point, our initial application was broader, but we inquired and we found the phone companies don't have that kind of information. So right now, we are seeking simply the cell towers associated with actual calls or text messages of customers.
About one cell phone.
Each of the applications specifies a particular cell phone and asks for the records associated with that cell phone over a 60-day period.
The phone number identifying a phone that has to be used by a caller, but it doesn't, the information wouldn't reflect to whom the call was made.
The location information doesn't tell us the location information of the person calling. We'll know the number of the person calling or called.
So, identify which tower that person is.
No, it does not. No, it's not. The location information is simply the location information of the particular phone that we're interested in.
But you want the location information of this phone for 60 days, wherever it's picked up by any tower operated by this company or this system.
When a call is made, when the phone is actually in use, we're seeking information associated with actual calls and text messages sent to or from the phone during a 60-day period.
So that would allow you to know where this phone was during all of those calls during 60 days.
That's right, Your Honor, provided the person made a call. If they just go someplace and don't use the phone, then we wouldn't know anything about that. But if they go someplace and do use a call, then we would get some limited information about the location of where they were. It wouldn't be exact, but we would know the location of the nearby cell tower. No law requires the phone companies to store this information in the first place. The information is stored solely at the discretion of the phone company. There's nothing that requires them to maintain it for any particular period of time, and there's nothing that requires them to store this information in the first place.
There's no law that requires this? There's no law that requires the companies to keep this information?
No, there's not. They do it at their own discretion. It's entirely up to them. If a company wanted to not store this information at all for calls, that would be entirely appropriate to do so. We're getting only information which is stored at the discretion of the phone company. And so the records are the company's own observations regarding its own service, made and kept at its own discretion of its own equipment that's used to process a call. I want to make two primary points about this kind of information and why it does not violate the Fourth Amendment when we use a 2703D order to obtain this information. First, there's no reasonable expectation, a customer has no reasonable expectation of privacy in this information under the reasoning of Smith v. Maryland and United States v. Miller. Second, in this case, because these business records made solely at the discretion of the phone company, the phone company's role here is really that of a prospective witness, that is, someone who, acting entirely on their own, has made observations which are relevant and material to a criminal investigation. And the long tradition for these cases is that the government has the right to every person's evidence when it's relevant to a criminal investigation, when the government asks for it in response to lawful compulsory process. And there such information, the scope of the information the government can get is judged based on a reasonableness standard. That is, the information has to be relevant to an investigation and not overly burdensome on the provider. And but there's no rule that the scope of information the government can obtain is somehow limited by the interest of the subject of the investigation.
It's my understanding that the magistrate found that you had established the statutory predicate for getting an order within his discretion, but he didn't deal with that, and he simply declared this statute unconstitutional.
That's correct, Your Honor. The magistrate judge found that we had met the specific and articulable facts statutory standard, but held that that statute violated the Constitution, and that ruling was affirmed by the district court.
If we were to disagree with his constitutionality ruling, would we have to reach that? We'd have to decide that constitutional issue, or could we avoid deciding the constitutional issue and say that he shouldn't have reached it and under the statute remand it back to him to exercise his discretion?
Your Honor, we believe that when the government satisfies the standards of Section 2703, it's mandatory that the magistrate judge issue a 2703D order.
But if we disagree with you on that, and we disagree with him on his constitutional ruling, would it be appropriate for us to send this case back to and order him to exercise his discretion under the statute based on your showing?
I think so, Your Honor. I mean, I much disagree with the notion that the magistrate judge has discretion to refuse to issue an order.
I understand that.
But in that case, I think it probably would be appropriate to
the Third Circuit.
Man on that.
Disagrees with you, did it?
That's correct, Your Honor. I would note that we agree with the interpretation of the statute provided or given by District Court Judge O'Grady in the Eastern District of Virginia case. And we believe that the proper interpretation of the statute, that you have to look at the statute as a whole. And first, Section 2703C of the statute gives the government the discretion over the ways that it can obtain this kind of information, and it provides that one of the options for the government is it can obtain a court order for disclosure under subsection 2703D. 2703D says that a court order for disclosure under subsection B or C may be issued by a court, the court of competent jurisdiction, and that may be issued language sort of sets the jurisdictional
that's
basis.
That's what the Third Circuit
right.
said.
Right, but then
makes
the statute
permissive.
Yes,
permissive.
That's a permissive. But then the language says, and shall issue only if the government offers specific and articulable facts show the records are relevant material to an ongoing investigation. We think the and shall issue makes the statute mandatory. And it's true, as the Third Circuit notes, that the statute goes on to say it's only if you offer specific and articulable facts. And that makes offering specific and articulable facts a necessary but not a sufficient condition. But what the Virginia court said, which I think is what makes the most sense under the statute, is what makes it mandatory is that you not only offer the specific and articulable facts under 2703D, but you also have to meet the requirements of Section 2703C. That is, you can only obtain a 2703D order if you are seeking it from a provider of electronic communication service, which is what the phone company is here, and if you are if the records that you're seeking are non-content records related to a customer or subscriber of an electronic communication service. So it's when we meet all of those three conditions that the statute becomes mandatory. And I would just note that the Third Circuit's interpretation, among other flaws, sort of reads out entirely from the statute the "and shall issue" language. You know, theirs is really, it's just "may issue," and doesn't, their interpretation just does not make that "and shall" language operative at all, which is, you know, unusual, because "shall" is usually very significant as a language of command.
So if we agree with you on that, then we must have necessarily reached the constitutional issue to see if the statute's constitutional. Is that right?
We certainly think it's appropriate for you to do so. We think that a court in issuing an ex parte order like this has the discretion to consider the constitutionality of the execution. On the other hand, the statute is entitled to a presumption of constitutionality. So it would be, you know, if the court doesn't want, if it wants to just say that the order must be issued because we've met the statutory standard, that's appropriate, and it would not be absolutely essential for you, for the court at this time, to consider the Fourth Amendment application to historical business records. But we believe it's entirely appropriate for the court to do so, and that there's more than the court has sufficient facts to consider the records that we've given the court and conclude that the statute is consistent with the Constitution.
To me, it is critical to know exactly what information that is being obtained in these three cases. And there's this discussion of what other party, the ACLU, has developed and whether or not to take judicial notice of it. But is there any reason why? Of course, I haven't read the record, so all I've looked at are these briefs and what was in the record excerpts. But is there any question in this record that as it comes to us as to exactly what you're seeking and exactly what the magistrate's order following 2703 would give to you? I opened that up earlier, and I thought I understood what you were saying, but isn't that clear exactly what you're going to get? And you said that the phone company, they may change what they store. But in this case, we know, or do we, exactly what you would get. Seems to me like our test of privacy, the right of privacy, is going to depend on what information you're going to get under the statute and the facts. Now, where am I lost?
Your Honor, the information in the record, which tells you the facts of what we're going to get, are we showed an exemplar from T-Mobile, and we have an affidavit from Metro PCS regarding the kind of record they have. What we could draft and submit to the court a proposed draft order, which would specify the kind of information we're seeking that I described at the initial, one of my initial comments, and I'd be happy to draft up a proposed order.
Well, we can't tell from this record what they have exactly that you would obtain.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. That's a normal course of this compulsory process, is we never know exactly what the phone company has until after we obtain the information.
Now, that being true, may it not be that the technology will change, the company will have a lot more information as a result of this one call, or each call, that would create more of a privacy problem that would be more like the beeper on the car than the case we have before us today?
Certainly it's possible in the future.
If the magistrate realized that, the magistrate would know that there's a constitutional problem, and more than continuing investigation would be required to just probable cause.
Well,
is that not a possibility for future decision under this statute?
I think the government is likely to know when the records that the phone company has actually change. And so, you know, we're aware of what they have now, and that's what we're arguing that we're entitled to get. We don't think the court is required in this case to address every possible future technology which may be developed.
Right.
But you're not asking for information as to what this specific phone, what numbers that phone calls. You're only getting the information from the towers, correct?
We also ask for information. I mean, with the tower record comes information associated with the numbers called by the telephone. So you get the number of the telephone, you get the number of the numbers associated with
the
phone.
Does it show the location of the phone that is called?
No, it does not, Your Honor.
You're only getting the towers for the phone that you have identified as having some sort of criminal interest or whatever.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's all we're asking for.
And we do have your articulation of why you need this evidence in the record, even though we don't know what you're apt to get back. Is that the situation we're in?
That's correct, Your Honor. We described the facts of the criminal investigation in the course of the applications, and they provide that's the necessary evidentiary threshold for us to meet in order to get this information.
And why is this phone? Why have you articulated that the location of this phone is relevant to your investigation?
Well, there's three separate applications that were under appeal. One of them involves a phone in possession of someone who is dealing drugs. Another involves a phone in possession of someone who's involved in alien smuggling. And another involves a phone in the possession of a member of a gang involved in extortion and other violent crimes.
Of course, it's been years now, so all of this is relatively...
That's correct, Your Honor.
We just want a declaration or a reversal of the magistrate's finding.
The investigations remain ongoing, Your Honor, and we're still interested in obtaining information in these cases.
They're still pending?
They are still pending, Your Honor.
Oh, they've been a couple of years.
And they have, Your Honor. So we believe that customers have no reasonable expectation of privacy in the contents of these records under the principles of Smith v. Maryland, the Supreme Court's Pen Register case. First, in Smith v. Maryland, the Supreme Court held that people when they dial a telephone number, that they are conveying information to the phone company. And here, similarly, when people use cell phones, they know that that their signal is transmitted to a cell tower. People are familiar in the ordinary course of their use of cell phones with the fact they have to be in transmission distance of a cell tower and typically see an icon on their phone demonstrating the signal strength. Here, if anything, we think the privacy interest is less for the cell phone user because the cell phone user actually doesn't know the particular exact location of the cell phone company's cell tower. That's information which is generated internally by the cell tower and that the user is going to have a lesser privacy interest in. Second, in Smith v. Merrill.
What would be the difference, so far as our concern goes, between the traditional subpoena to the telephone company for the PIN register, if they were all long-distance calls, what would be the difference between getting all their long-distance calls and this cell phone tower connection information you get in this case?
We don't think there's a difference, Your Honor. We think these are just business records created by the phone company at its discretion. The Supreme Court in Smith v. Maryland also looked at the phone books of the time, which informed customers that the phone company could help customers trace the source of their calls if they were unwanted calls. And here the terms of service are much more explicit than the phone books of the time, telling customers explicitly that the phone companies collect and store these location records. And moreover, the terms of service here are part of an explicit contractual relationship between the phone company and the provider. So that provides an additional reason why a person has no expectation of privacy in this kind of information.
You mean those tiny little pamphlets you get with the tiny little words?
Uh, I, uh, Typically, if you go to their website, that's the place that I see it, you know, on the first page of
the
website. They may be on that as well. I see them from the website, a link from the first page, and they're in normal print and very plain English. In addition, the Supreme Court in Smith v. Maryland said there was no reasonable expectation of privacy because of the basic Fourth Amendment principle is information that you voluntarily disclose to a third party, that it doesn't violate your rights when that information is then turned over to the government. And this really is a case where the provider is acting, is really functioning simply as a witness, and so the government has the right to every person's evidence. And you know, this tradition has been going for 450 years. The Supreme Court has traced it back as far as 1562, and I think it's in law enforcement fundamentally needs building blocks in which to develop probable cause for investigations, and cell site information is one of those business building blocks which is critical to law enforcement today. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Very well.
You are representing yourself.
Yes, in the Fourth Amendment. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I am Susan Freewald, and I'm a professor of law at the University of San Francisco School of Law. The lower courts properly held that the Fourth Amendment requires a warrant based on probable cause when government agents compel a service provider to disclose location data of the type sought here. And if I may just take a moment, I would like to read to the court the application that the government submitted to the magistrate judge in the case below. There were three applications, and they're all quite similar. And the government asked for the target device, records or other information pertaining to the subscriber or customer, including historical cell site information and call detail records. And call detail records include a record of incoming calls and cell site sectors used by the mobile telephone to obtain service for a call or when in an idle state, which means when the phone is used as a phone but not actually making a call or receiving a call, but rather just on, whenever it is on, which means whenever the phone travels with you day to day or when it's carried in your purse or pocket throughout the day, 24 hours.
But they've since given up on that, is that right?
Well, there are two things about that. First of all, as the government noted, they haven't submitted a new application, so I'm not sure what it means to give up on that. And secondly, I think the issue before the court is what is the information available to the government on a 2703D order. And the government argues that when they ask for records of a communication, records associated with communications, they are able to acquire any records. And so the application shows us what the government considers to be a record. The other thing that the government asked for was for the United States to be provided on a continuous basis with the origination of a call, cell site information for the origination of a call, the answer of a call, the termination of a call, or if reasonably available during the progress of the call, as soon as the information was received and stored. In other words, and this is in my brief, the government asked for records to be created on an ongoing basis and then sent to the investigating agency. So what this shows is that the government's distinction between historical data and prospective data is one that is not workable on a practical basis. And a lot of their argument for why historical data should be treated as less private than prospective data falls away in practice. Now, I know that the court is concerned, as it properly should be, about what's going on in other cases that the magistrates are aware of where the government is asking for this type of data. And in other cases, the government has asked for registration data, duration data, as they're asked for in this case, data where if you, and I know Judge Clement was asking about this, if you ask for the information about a particular target and who that target calls, they've also asked for the location data associated with those targets. There are cases that are just now coming out of the Southern District of Texas where the government is asking for the use of cell tower dumps, which means for a particular cell tower, actually it's for all the cell towers of providers in a particular area, what are all the cell phones around that tower at a particular time. In one case it was an hour before and an hour afterwards. What were all the people, every single person who used all the provider's towers in a particular place for an hour before and an hour after a particular event occurred, usually a crime. And for all of this information, the government is claiming that they do not need to get a warrant because this information is not subject to reasonable expectation of privacy, and similarly, that they are themselves able to police themselves. And I think the Katz case established very clearly that it is not up to the government to limit itself, but rather must be up to a neutral magistrate to ensure that the constraints are imposed by the judiciary and not by the police themselves. And so so let me talk a little bit more about why it, yes? Yes, Your Honor.
Would the request for the information still specify a particular phone number?
No, Your Honor. No, in fact, there's a case that just came out where the court was particularly concerned because it did not ask for a phone number. They were trying. Oh, no, here, no, exactly. Here they asked for a particular phone number, yes. I was merely using the cell tower dump to show exactly the scope of information that the government claims to be available under a D order, which is why, because the issue for me is whether.
That's not before us.
No, it's not before you. No, yes, thank you. So what is before you is the question of whether the government can effectively transform cell phones into tracking devices that follow us wherever we go and record our movements in such a way as to intrude upon reasonable expectations of privacy without the protections of the warrant requirement. And the principal argument that the government uses for why they don't need a warrant is that the third-party rule defeats our expectations of privacy. And they rely on two cases for that, the Smith versus Maryland case that you've heard about and the U.S. versus Miller case. And both cases do not apply to the surveillance at issue. Smith versus Maryland doesn't apply because the technology of the pen register is incredibly primitive as compared to the surveillance conducted by location data acquisition. It's interesting because it used to be that people said that that the Smith versus Maryland case established that non-content information was unprotected. And of course, Smith versus Maryland didn't say that. It just said that telephone numbers were unprotected. But after Jones, no one just says that anymore because the Jones case established that non-content information, location data, is subject to a reasonable expectation of privacy. What Smith versus Maryland established was that the telephone numbers dialed by a pen register, which was able to determine when a landline phone in a house dialed a particular number, it wasn't a phone that was carried with you wherever you went as a cell phone is, that those telephone numbers dialed actively and knowingly by the person who used the landline phone, that those telephone numbers dialed were not subject to reasonable expectation of privacy. It is of a different nature both in scope and scale to use a tracking device, your cell phone as a tracking device, to record where you go throughout the day, how long you spend there. It is a much more intrusive technology. It is a technological method that is hidden, intrusive, indiscriminate, and continuous, much more akin to location tracking in Jones, to wiretapping in Katz, and it is the Smith versus Maryland decision is just inapposite.
Jeff?
Well, so it turns out that people use their phones maybe at least 50 times a day. And I think the number's in the hundreds if you count texts or checking their email. That's the average. I think it's the teenagers, actually. you're not checking Facebook like most people are. Neither am I. But in any case... but in any case, remember that the phone actually, particularly if we're talking about idle state or registration data, every time the phone has to check in with the tower, because in case you're receiving a call, the cell phone company needs to know where your phone is, and so the phone has to register with the tower pretty continuously so that it knows where to direct the call. And continuous doesn't have to mean, you know, every second, even though it could. It just means that there is a continuous picture that allows the government to paint a portrait of where you are, to create a virtual map. So it's continuous in the sense that effectively you have, just like wiretapping is continuous, even if they're not listening to a call every minute, they're listening to calls, they're doing searches over time such that the initial justification for the search may wear out over time, and that's why you need the neutral magistrate to oversee the process more so than in other cases, because there are a series of searches. In the Miller case, this magistrate has. I don't think that this magistrate. He also has. In this case, for example, he gave the government ample opportunity to respond to the findings of fact. He's one of the most scholarly magistrates I've ever observed. I think he has an opinion, but I don't know of a judge who doesn't have an opinion. But in general, the neutral magistrate language, of course, comes from Katz and Berger. In Miller, the government posits that Miller establishes a rule that all business records are subject to no reasonable expectations of privacy, and that's, of course, not what Miller says. In the Miller court, the Supreme Court went through an exhaustive analysis of whether these particular records at issue were subject to no reasonable expectation of privacy before they decided that compulsory process was okay as opposed to a warrant. And they looked at the bank customer's relationship to the bank and how those records were created. And they recognized, particularly in applying the Hoffa precedent, that the bank customer created the records with the bank as a party. And so the bank customer wrote checks to the bank, made deposits with the bank, and the bank was a party. The employees were meant to see the records and to transact with these negotiable instruments. And therefore, just as a person, as Hoffa had assumed the risk that the person with whom he spoke would be untrustworthy, the bank customer assumed the risk that the bank employees would be forced to disclose the information. Now, in the case of the subscriber of the cell phone, it's an entirely different relationship with the cell phone provider. And the relationship is much more akin to the relationship that a person has with a service provider who's an intermediary. And that is what the Warshak Court recognized in the Sixth Circuit when drawing on the line of cases that ran through Katz, but that started with Ex parte Jackson, that recognized privacy in the mail, that also recognized privacy in a hotel room, despite access by the house cleaning staff, that recognized privacy in stored packages, in safe deposit boxes, said that mere access by the provider does not defeat the expectation of privacy. And in fact, Judge Clement and Judge Reveley, I know you had a case, the Zafuto case in the Fifth Circuit, where you recognized that even though the police had maintained in the station records of all the phone calls made in the station, the police officer could have an expectation of privacy that mere access to those calls, to his calls, did not defeat his reasonable expectation of privacy that his personal call was not recorded, even though that was incorrect. So the rule is not that whenever someone has access to information, in this case, the cell phone provider has access to location records, that mere access is enough to defeat an expectation of privacy. The question is, how are those records created, and what is my relationship to those records, and have I assumed the risk that those records would be disclosed? And the answer is not when the person who has access to them is a mere intermediary. And if that weren't the rule, then Katz wouldn't have been decided the way it was. And so there is no third-party rule that says any information that a third party has, anything we can call a record, is subject to no expectation of privacy. Because then Katz would be incorrect, Warshak would be incorrect. And so let me just say that this court should take this opportunity, because the question is squarely before you, to recognize that the Fourth Amendment requires a warrant for this extremely intrusive form of surveillance. Without the warrant requirement, agents are engaging in wide-scale and mass surveillance of innocent people and in ways that infringe upon not only privacy rights, but First Amendment rights of association and expression. And we need the warrant requirement to rein in the scope and scale of this mass surveillance to ensure that the law enforcement has an adequate justification for this surveillance, to make sure that that the Fourth Amendment keeps up with new technologies, and to make sure that it has meaning in these times, and to protect our rights today. If there are no further questions, I will be done.
Thank you, Ms. Freeborn.
Thank you.
Mr. Fahoney.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm Hani Fakouri of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and I'm here arguing on behalf of the remaining amicus organizations in this case. Your Honors, in Kilo versus United States, the Supreme Court worried about the power of technology to shrink the realm of guaranteed privacy. And today, this Court is yet again confronted with this struggle. The information sought here, approximately 60 days worth of an individual's patterns of movements, reveals a wealth of sensitive information, including familial, political, professional, and religious associations created by the march of technology. And ultimately, Your Honors, the lower courts got it right. While law enforcement should be able to have access to this information in order to solve crimes and keep us safe, it should only be able to do so if it obtains a search warrant supported by probable cause. And this Court has two ways to reach this result. The first is the constitutional arguments raised by Professor Freewald, and that I'd like to echo briefly, in that the Fourth Amendment requires law enforcement to obtain a search warrant to access location information. And I'll discuss the technology at issue and why its capabilities means that a search warrant is required. And I'll also discuss how the third-party doctrine doesn't change that result. But this Court, as Judge Dennis noted, does have a second alternative way to reach that result, and that is to adopt the approach of the Third Circuit and find that magistrate judges or district court judges considering these orders under Section 2703D do have discretion to require the government to apply for a search warrant. But I'll begin by talking about the technology and honing in on a point that Judge Reveley mentioned, which is that the technology will change. Again, in Kilo, the Supreme Court made clear when it said, quote, it would be foolish to contend that the degree of privacy secured to citizens by the Fourth Amendment has been entirely unaffected by the advance of technology. And in fact, what Kilo said was that courts must take into account not only technology in use, but also technology in development. And that's precisely what Judge Smith did here. He made
Why do we have to do that, though? Why don't we just decide these three cases and leave it open to a case that has different facts? Just as always, the magistrate has to decide the particular facts of the affidavits.
Your Honor, I think there's two reasons why I'd ask the Court to confront these issues. And the first is, while this case may be, according to the government, narrow, the implications, I think, are much broader, because, as Professor Freewald mentioned, we're already beginning to see an expansion of the types of data that not only the cell phone companies are able to provide law enforcement, but also, accordingly, the types of requests law enforcement make to the providers in order to assist with law enforcement investigation. And the second reason, Your Honor, is the lower courts are in a bit of a disarray over this. I know Judge Clement mentioned that Judge Smith is kind of outspoken about this, but he's not the only one. In fact, there have been a number of other decisions by courts, not only within the Fifth Circuit, other judges in the Southern District of Texas, for example, but also courts throughout this country who are struggling with and grappling with these issues. And I think guidance by the circuit-level courts, particularly the Fifth Circuit, which covers a wide swath of the population, is important to help not only courts who are struggling with these issues now, but who are also likely to get one of these gradually increasing requests that law enforcement makes, and to really look and think about the types of implications in the future that this decision in these three specific cases will have. And I think, again, going back to Judge Smith's findings of fact, ultimately he made findings of facts 2 years ago that said the technology was changing, and he was right.
Well, you just excuse me, but I just don't see us announcing a law that you have to have the probable cause showing for this magistrate under this statute, period. I can't see us saying that.
Well, Your Honor, I think what the court can say, and I'd urge the court to say it, is that whenever the government attempts to obtain information that paints a revealing and intimate and intricate portrait of a person's movements over an extended period of time, that request triggers a reasonable expectation of privacy and requires a search warrant before the government can access it. And I would note that just earlier this year, in the Jones opinion, the Supreme Court, while their holding didn't necessarily address the reasonable expectation of privacy in movement, there's certainly a suggestion by the five members of the concurring opinion that they were certainly concerned at the threat of long-term location surveillance that technology enables the government to engage in. Obviously, 100 years ago, this wasn't a real problem because it would have been too expensive, too difficult for the government to engage in. In Jones, it was 28 days worth of tracking a person's movements. But now we've seen the technology changing in a way where the government can simply ask the phone company for 60 days worth of this information, and they can obtain it quickly and easily and cheaply. And ultimately, they can use that information to paint this intricate, intimate portrait of where a person moves, and not only where they specifically go to, but also, and I think more importantly, their patterns of movement. Do they have a certain routine? Do they go a certain route from home to the office, to the doctor's office, to a gay bar, to a particular church or mosque or synagogue? Whatever it may be, the government is able to obtain that much more intricate portrait that it wasn't able to obtain before. And again, Your Honors, I think it's safe to say it's a self-evident truth, in fact, that the information at issue here only becomes more precise as the technology advances. And ultimately, the implications of that, and why I would urge the court to consider the constitutional issues, is that we're reaching a point where this technology enables the government to be able to see inside the house, for example, which obviously is the paramount concern of the Fourth Amendment and an extremely constitutionally protected place. And again, I've already mentioned the problems with the aggregation of public movements. And Justice Sotomayor in her concurring opinion in Jones highlighted the concern with that. And I would disagree with the government on the argument that this data is not as precise as the GPS data, because again, the reality is that probably every single person in this courtroom has a cell phone, and they probably have it with them today. And most people travel to and from their work or home or business or whatever they're going with their cell phone. And that gives the government an opportunity to know where people are traveling in a particular point in time. And it's a much more personal object. It follows us. The GPS that was attached to Mr. Jones's car in the Jones decision, it was a proxy for Mr. Jones's location only part of the time, only to the extent that he was driving the car. But cars obviously spend a lot of time in a parking lot or parked in a garage, for example, whereas your cell phone can travel places your car cannot. And ultimately, if 28 days was considered to be too long in the Jones decision, then I think the 60 days here is certainly crosses that threshold of too long, too intrusive in order to trigger the Fourth Amendment.
Let me ask a question I maybe know the answer to, but will this information tell any more than the number or maybe the tower? It will not tell you the exact location of the receiving phone, will it?
It will tell you the location of the specific tower which the person connected to.
Right, right.
But ultimately, Your Honor, and I think this is something that Judge Smith touched upon, is there's no dispute that the number of towers are increasing, particularly in areas with bigger populations. The number of towers have increased to the point where it becomes very easy for the government to pinpoint your specific location. In one of the amicus briefs that the Electronic Privacy Information Center submitted, they noted that a search through publicly available information demonstrated that on, and I'll probably butcher the pronunciation and I apologize, but on South Marathi Street, where the federal building is, they estimate there's approximately 200 antenna and 50 cell site towers just around the Fifth Circuit's building. And because cell phones are becoming more prevalent and because there's increasing demand for web-enabled smartphones that require more data connections, cell phone providers are increasing the number of towers they're installing throughout the United States. And ultimately what that means is that even that little discrete piece of information, the location of the specific tower, can reveal more to law enforcement today than it could 10 years ago, probably than it could even in 2010 when Judge Smith was considering these orders. And that's something that the court needs to keep in mind when deciding, when thinking about these issues and hopefully adopting a Fourth Amendment search warrant requirement. Obviously, the traditional balance between allowing law enforcement to investigate crime and privacy has been a search warrant. And a search warrant, I think, creates a higher standard for disclosure. It provides more judicial oversight. It allows the judge to receive the return to supervise what the officers on the ground are doing. But it's also not an enormous burden on law enforcement. They're already before the judge anyway in order to obtain the order under 2703D. So just imposing the search warrant requirement heightens their standard and it provides better judicial oversight and supervision, but it's a necessary additional burdens in order to protect the Fourth Amendment. I'll talk briefly about the third party doctrine just to echo some of the points that Professor Freewald mentioned. And that is specifically, there's always been limitations to the idea that privacy is lost once information is turned over to a third party or access is turned over to a third party. And she already went through Ex parte Jackson and Katz, and I won't belabor the point. But I do want to focus again on the fact that the technology at issue here is far different than the technology at issue in both Smith or Miller. Again, you know, the difference between the call records in Smith and the cell site location information is that the records of your phone numbers dialed only reveals a discrete amount of information. It doesn't tell you whether a phone call was connected. It only reveals information about that phone in one particular place inside the house. Whereas the location cell site tower information, for example, can, again, as I've already talked about, reveal a much more precise, intricate picture of where you are. And again, I wanted to point also that in a difference between the records at issue here and the records at issue in Miller, the bank records, was that there's a real question about whether the records, the cell site records, are voluntarily conveyed from the user to the cell phone provider the same way that the bank records are turned over. In fact, that's exactly what the Third Circuit found when they found the records were not voluntarily conveyed in a meaningful way. And Judge Clement, your point about the tiny print is, I think, the reality. Everyone's clicked through 1,000 of those things in their lifetime while using the web or signing up for any sort of service. In fact, if you go to sign up for a cell phone, for example, and you're given a 2-year contract to sign, oftentimes they just say sign here on page 5. Most people sign without even reading the fine print, and then that gets thrown.
That's their problem.
You're absolutely right.
So you say it's voluntary. It's not voluntary. Nobody makes people have cell phones. I mean, if you're up to no good, maybe you ought to not have a cell phone.
Well, Your Honor, I agree that no one's required to have a cell phone, but I think it's safe to say that it's become a, I wouldn't say a necessity of life, but it's almost there. Even in Smith, it's voluntary to own the cell phone, sure, but to the extent.
Go along with all the agreements, all the disclosure information, all the risks involved.
Absolutely, Your Honor, but I think we have to focus on the fact that the Fourth Amendment has never, well, that the Fourth Amendment doesn't have to compromise between living in the conveniences of our technological world means that you have to throw away your privacy rights. And I think importantly, the fact that while it's truly voluntary to have the phone and perhaps sign the agreements, and obviously consumers should do a better job of probably reading through those things, that doesn't necessarily translate into the fact, into an idea that you forever surrender all your privacy rights. And I think the reality is, even Justice Marshall in his dissenting opinion in Smith noted that a phone has become, and he was talking about a landline phone, it's become a modern way of life. Today, many people don't have landline phones. A cell phone is their only way to communicate. In fact, Congress has indicated that, you know, understanding that has told, for example, cell phone companies to increase their precision of their network so that people can make 911 phone calls on their cell phones, for example. So I think all of that reflects the growing understanding that cell phones are becoming a way of life, a ubiquitous way of life. There's a sign outside the courthouse door that says to make sure the phone is off because it's presumed that most people are going to walk in. And my time has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Judish.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, Amici's speak in this case of a need to rein in the government from engaging in mass surveillance. But this isn't like the warrantless GPS tracking of Jones. Congress has already reined in mass surveillance. It has imposed a really substantial and meaningful burden on the government to obtain this information. We have to go to a court and get a court order based on specific and articulable facts. The information we're seeking is relevant and material to an ongoing criminal investigation. So there's I think, Your Honor, we need mechanisms. A warrant can only be used to obtain evidence of crime, whereas here, 2703D orders are often used for information which is relevant material to investigation, helps develop a fuller picture, but it may not themselves actually, not all the information may actually constitute evidence of crime.
Which is why the statute was passed.
Yes, Your Honor. And moreover, you know, there are some situations where it really can make a difference for public safety. I mean, you might imagine a situation where a child is kidnapped and the parents say something along the lines of, we don't know who would have done it, but there's this one guy we know, he's sort of made us uncomfortable or uneasy or something like that. You know, at that point, I don't think the government would have probable cause to obtain a warrant for that person of interest's cell phone, but they very likely would have sufficient basis to get a 2703D order. And so, you know, being able to get that information right then makes a big difference, and it may, you know, make a really meaningful difference in the life of the potential victim. I think the question comes up of the precision of the data in this case. I think it's worth taking a look at the case we mentioned in our 28J letter, United States v. Madison. That involved getting information from MetroPCS, one of the providers here, at the same time we filed our applications, which is around October of 2010. And in that case, the court found as a finding of fact and said the defense counsel didn't dispute that the records obtained could not be used to pinpoint the defendant and were accurate only to within a few city blocks. And yet they were quite important in that case because they showed that the defendant had traveled to another town in the middle of the night where certain cars were stolen, which were subsequently used in an armed robbery in which a guard was killed. So the data isn't precise, and yet it can be extremely important to law enforcement. The government in this case does rely heavily on Smith v. Maryland and United States v. Miller, but I want to make clear that that is not the sole basis of our Fourth Amendment argument. Both of those cases, in fact, had factors which made them more difficult Fourth Amendment questions than the one here. In Miller, there was the Bank Secrecy Act, which is a mandatory data retention act, which forced the banks to retain the information the government was seeking. And so the court has to be very careful in that case to make sure what it's getting is only business records. In Smith v. Maryland, the phone company was acting as an agent of the government engaging in ongoing prospective surveillance. So again, you have to make sure that you're not getting anything other than stuff which is transmitted to the bank, to the phone company in the ordinary course of business. Here,
why did the phone companies retain this information?
I'm not entirely sure, Your Honor. I expect it helps them with things like the load balance on their network and stuff like that, or it may help them if they have disputes with customers over the quality of service or things like that. But it really, it's up to them on what they want. On the,
some technical.
Yes, I can't, I'm just not certain why they retain it or their basis for the length of time they do it. In other Supreme Court cases which haven't raised the difficulties we had in Miller and Smith v. Maryland, the Supreme Court has dealt with the Fourth Amendment issue much more easily. Examples of that are the financial records of the SEC v. Jerry T. O'Brien case or the employment records in the Donaldson case. In those cases, it was sufficient to observe that the information was records in possession of a third party, and that disclosed or disposed of any Fourth Amendment interests on behalf of the customers. If you have no more questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Judge.
Thank you.
Work both in your brief and in your oral argument. Great to see you.
Thank you.
Good job. Court will